This weekend starts right after this.
When shopping for car insurance, consider this. GEICO has been saving people money on car insurance for over 75 years. So if you're serious about savings, it's simple. Go to geico.com. After 75 years, they know how to save you money.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
The dangers of pre-diabetes. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us, first weekend in August. Here's what's coming up this hour. 84 million American adults have pre-diabetes and 90% of them don't know it. We'll explain what it is and what to look for. Also, the Dodgers are having a spectacular season, but a good number of fans can't watch them on TV thanks to a cable TV dispute. Plus, the technologies that we need to change the world and the new way to calm anxious flyers at Cincinnati Northern Kentucky Airport.
Travelers who are nervous about flying, they bring in these mini horses twice a month, and they basically wander around the sort of non-secure areas of the terminal when passengers enter and get off the planes. You can pet them, take pictures of them, hang out with them, whatever you want to do.
Who needs drugs or booze when there are mini horses? Wall Street Journal reporter Shabani Matani is here with a travel trend later in the hour. Well, the newest CDC report reveals more than 84 million American adults have pre-diabetes, a serious health condition that can lead to diabetes if left untreated. And how about this? Nearly 90% of people with pre-diabetes don't even know they have it, and they aren't aware of the long-term risks to their health or that it can be reversed. More on an awareness campaign for the American Diabetes Association. We're joined now by Dr. William Cefalu, Chief Scientific, Medical, and Mission Officer. Dr. Cefalu, what is it?
Prediabetes is a state where there is an elevated blood glucose level, but not at levels that we consider diagnostic for type 2, or used to be called the adult onset diabetes. So at this particular stage, the individual is asymptomatic, doesn't have any symptoms, yet prediabetes is associated with increased heart disease and stroke. So it's a real issue, and many of these individuals may actually progress over years to develop type 2 diabetes. And as you know, type 2 diabetes, if not adequately controlled, leads to complications such as blindness and heart disease and kidney disease.
How would we know if we have prediabetes?
There's very few symptoms, but what we do suggest is individuals take a risk test. And if they go to the website, doihaveprediabetes.org, there are a number of factors associated with prediabetes. And a very simple risk test, they can answer whether they are man or woman, answer whether they are physically active, whether they are overweight, and depending on their certain ethnic group, you add up these points. And if you have a certain amount of points, that means that you're high risk for developing prediabetes or diabetes. And at that particular point, we encourage them to see their physician, their provider, and to get a simple blood test that will make the diagnosis.
Is this something that might get picked up during an annual checkup or not necessarily?
It can be picked up during an annual checkup if there is a heightened awareness. But once again, we need to make sure that both the patient, the individual who's at high risk, and the provider have a heightened awareness of this condition so that something can be done about it.
We're speaking with Dr. William Cefalu, American Diabetes Association. He is the Chief Scientific, Medical, and Mission Officer there. We're talking about this new campaign about pre-diabetes awareness. Give us some stats here, because the numbers are staggering, aren't they, with regards to diabetes?
Well, there's 84 million Americans who have prediabetes. That's about 33% of the population. Over 12% of adults in the United States have diabetes at this particular point. The important thing to remember is that we have programs that can reverse prediabetes. Very simple lifestyle, losing 5 to 10% of your body weight, increasing your activity to 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week. These are scientifically validated programs that, if we have shown, can prevent the progression of diabetes by about 58%. Many of these programs now have been translated down to the community. And once again, if you go to doihavediabetes.org, you can actually see the list of resources in the community that the individual can go to see if they would qualify for one of these prevention programs. So doihavediabetes.org has the risk test. It has tips toward healthy living, but more importantly, it has the resources the individual may need in order to begin this process.
How many people with prediabetes or actual diabetes, I guess, could have prevented it?
We know that with the scientific studies, a 58% risk reduction with lifestyle alone. So that's a tremendous amount. So you're essentially talking about halving the number of new cases of prediabetes.
Mm. That's management, or that's prevention, or a little of both?
This is, management, lifestyle management will indeed serve the purpose of prevention or delay the onset of type 2 diabetes.
Okay.
So
the
studies have shown that lifestyle can really treat the person to where you can really delay the time that that individual develops type 2 diabetes.
Just to clear up some semantics here, if you are diabetic and you do a great job managing it, do you become a former diabetic, or do you never, or are you always a diabetic?
If you have diabetes and you do a great job of managing the condition, such as losing weight and exercising to where you have normal blood sugars, there's always that chance of reverting back to the increased sugar if the weight comes back on or the activities. And individuals with type 2 diabetes may do a great job initially, but as the condition progresses and over years, they may need medications to control their condition.
It's Dr. William Cefalu, Chief Scientific Medical and Mission Officer at the American Diabetes Association. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, if the Dodgers have some great highlights, but they're not on TV, are they really highlights? Spending part of your weekend with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 state for business, Michigan. Contact michiganbusiness.org today. Well, there are cable TV disputes. Then there's one involving the Los Angeles Dodgers, Sportsnet LA, Charter Communications, and DirecTV. At a time when regional sports networks are hugely contentious components of cable packages because of their high costs, these types of carriage disputes are not uncommon. But Wall Street Journal baseball writer Jared Diamond says the scope of the Dodgers' discord is virtually unprecedented. This has been going on since 2013, with a large portion of fans in the LA market unable to see the Dodgers on TV. Jared, what's up here?
So the basics are that the Los Angeles Dodgers are the best team in the major leagues. They play in the second biggest media market in the country, and a large percentage of their fans have been unable to watch their games on TV for four seasons. This is a dispute that's gone on since 2014 between Time Warner Cable, now Charter Communications, and DirecTV and other local pay TV providers in the LA area, who have refused to carry the Dodgers channel ever since it was founded before the 2014 season. And there's a lot of fans who are just powerless because they can't watch their team.
So for four seasons, nobody's felt any sort of desperate measure was necessary?
Clearly not yet. I think a big part of this goes from the fact that DirecTV, which is the second biggest cable provider, TV provider in LA after Charter Spectrum, just hasn't lost enough subscribers to make it worth its while to strike a deal at the price that Spectrum is still asking for. DirecTV has said they'd be willing to take the channel as sort of an a la carte option where only Dodgers fans could sign up for it. Charter Spectrum says no, it needs to be part of your cable bundles or your satellite bundles, which is the way that that industry has sort of always worked for a long time, and there's just been an impasse. And right now, there's still no real path to a resolution. There's no clear way this will get resolved anytime soon. I think this will just continue on into next year because really neither side seems really, there's no urgency to get something done.
So if fans started canceling their DirecTV subscription or Charter Communications subscription or switching carriers, would that get somebody's attention?
Oh, it absolutely would. It's just not happening. You know, there's a lot of Dodgers fans out there, but DirecTV has over a million households in the LA area, and realistically, how many of those million are watching the Dodgers? Not that many on the overall scale. It's a relatively small percentage of paid TV households that are going to actually watch the Dodgers games. And there's a lot of money being asked for this channel, and that's because Time Warner Cable, now Charter Spectrum, they agreed to pay the Dodgers $8.35 billion, billion with a B, to broadcast the Dodgers games for 25 years. They signed an enormous contract. They committed an enormous amount of money to broadcast the Dodgers, and a lot has changed in the TV business since then. A lot of people are cutting the cord. These TV rights deals aren't worth what they were even 5 years ago, and that's been a big cause of this problem, just the amount of money that that deal is worth, and these other paid TV providers saying it's not worth it to us to pay the rights fees, the distribution fees that you're asking for.
What about the Major League Baseball commissioner? Has he looked at this or offered to step in?
Not at this point. There are a lot of fans who would love to see Rob Manfred, MLB's commissioner, step in, but so far he's pretty much been hands-off. He says that, you know, they're talking to the parties involved, trying to get them to come to a deal, but he has not made any effort to really step in and broker it himself. I think a lot of that stems from the fact that ultimately, Rob Manfred, he represents the owners, and he's looking out for the owners' interest. And the Dodgers, in this case, they're not hurting. They are getting their $8.35 billion no matter who watches the games, no matter who has access to the games. Until the Dodgers really have a vested financial interest in getting a deal done, Rob Manfred's not going to step in. And I know that frustrates a lot of fans, but that's just the reality of the situation. The Dodgers are getting that money either way. The Dodgers lead the major leagues in attendance. They've led the league in attendance now for five straight seasons. Their payroll is the highest in the major leagues at around $250 million. And they're on pace to win about 114 games this season, which would make them one of the best teams in the history of baseball on the field. So really, everybody is winning, it seems like, except for the fans. They're the ones who are hurting, and unfortunately, in these situations, that always often seems like it's what happens. The big companies win and the fans lose.
Has there ever been a dispute that's gone on this long?
No, never anything quite like that. There have been disputes. You know, I'm from New York, and we've had this happen with the Yankees. But just last season, the Yankees and Comcast were not on all of last season. You know, the first year the YES Network, the Yankees channel, started, they weren't on Cablevision for an entire season. That was my cable provider growing up. I was, you know, 10, 12 years old, and for a full season didn't have the Yankees. It was really depressing for me as a child, but it got resolved.
Thanks, Jared. Wall Street Journal baseball writer Jared Diamond. 4 years that's been going on. That is ridiculous. 22 minutes now after the hour on this weekend. Glad you could be with us. You know, thousands of Americans are turned away by a company each year. Their business no longer welcome. Consumer advocate Chris Elliott says in extreme cases, the companies even keep your money, but usually the company just sends the customer packing without any recourse. There has to be a better and fairer way. Chris, what's this about?
Sad story, happens all too frequently. If you don't check in on time for your flight, they will cancel your reservation and they will not refund your money. You have to let the airline know before you the plane is departing that you're going to cancel. I mean, you can get a credit sometimes, but not always. And so what this woman thought, she was checking in on time, and she was a little bit late, got to the gate, and they told her that not only was her flight canceled, but she had lost all of her money. It's just another example of businesses saying, you know, your business is not welcome here, go away. I had several in this article, but it is probably the most frustrating is to know that you paid good money for a product that you now cannot use. And there are fixes for that, but unfortunately, a lot of people don't know that going into the summer.
All right, so what is the fix? Because as you said, that's a lot of money, and they're seemingly keeping it from her.
Hundreds of dollars, that's right. Unfortunately, in her case, there was no immediate fix, but you can take some preventive measures. And I mentioned this before. If you know that you're going to be late for a flight, you can actually call the airline and say, hey, I'm going to be late. They have something called the flat tire rule, And that said, if you're a little bit late for a flight because of a circumstance beyond your control, we'll go ahead and put you on the next available flight. She didn't do that, so as a result, her ticket was worthless. One of the other things, too, is you can dispute. If you think that you were on time and the airline is saying that you are not on time, you can actually say, look, my records say I was at the airport then, and I have actually seen people fight that and get at least a ticket credit. So don't just take this thing lying down and let them take your money. You can actually do an appeal and get some money back.
So not always dealing with a big business like an airplane or an airline, too. You point out this woman named, I think it's Thea Chasson. She wanted a haircut at this boutique shop in New Orleans that catered mostly to men, and she was turned down. Explain that scenario.
She had a skin condition where, you know, she didn't have a lot of hair, and she wanted them to actually shave her head, and they refused her service, which is surprisingly common. You think of something like that happening maybe in the 1950s and 60s during the Civil Rights Movement, but no, it still happens today. Businesses have certain rights. They can refuse people's service. You see the sign that says no shoes, no shirt, no service. But a lot of times that is a violation of the law. And what I mentioned in this piece is that you can actually invoke a state, local state and federal laws when you're being denied a service from a store, and you can at least get them to reconsider what they're doing. In her case, she did mention that she wanted to talk to a manager. They told her a manager was not available. She appealed to the Better Business Bureau. They couldn't help either. So her next best option was to actually shame the business and let everyone know that they had denied her a service. So the story was a part of that. And I think that the business, which I believe I mentioned in the article, is probably going to think twice before turning down another customer like her.
There's got to be a better way to do it. Just say, listen, I haven't seen your condition before. I'm just not comfortable doing it, and I don't want to, you know, cause you harm, right? I mean, there could have been multiple ways to do it other than say, we're not doing it.
Well, you know, I think that if you're going to hang out your shingle and say I'm cutting hair, then you should cut hair. And I think that for in this particular case, they thought that they could pick and choose what kind of hair, whose hair it cut.
Wow.
And that, unfortunately, that's not the way that their local laws there work. They have anti-discrimination laws on not only the local level but also the state and the federal level, where you can't just say, well, I'm not going to do business with you today, but I'm going to do business with someone else. It just doesn't work that way. So just simply pointing that out is sometimes enough.
That's Chris. That's consumer advocate Chris Elliott. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for three straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in defense, cybersecurity, mobility, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan among the top 10 states in the country for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. Thanks for spending your weekend with us. First full weekend in August. I'm Gordon Deal. Coming up this half hour, technologies we need to change the world. Also, forget the airport lounge. To calm yourself if you're an anxious flyer, pet the miniature horses. We'll tell you where. And the paralyzed hiker who's taking on a new hike after conquering all 2,200 miles of the Appalachian Trail. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Well, stroking lawyers' egos has become big business, a proliferation of attorney awards and rankings. More than 1,200 by one count is inundating law firm marketing departments, and an industry of consultants has popped up to guide law firms through the submissions process. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
The hottest field in law right now, perhaps ranking the lawyers. Sarah Randazzo of the Wall Street Journal has more. Sarah, why are there so many attorney awards and rankings?
Yeah, so there's a few factors that have contributed to where we are now, which is what some people tally as more than 1,200 rankings and awards globally that include lawyers, which is quite a staggering number. But the shortest answer is that law firms have deep pockets, and business interests have realized that and realized that they can award honors onto lawyers and then get law firms to pay for plaques and awards dinners and subscriptions, all. So there's basically an entire ecosystem now around making money off of awards to lawyers.
And what kinds of money are we talking about?
Well, I don't know the revenue of the awards makers, but on the law firm side, they're investing a ton of money into these. There's a study that was done last year by a few legal marketing groups that found law firms spend $157,000 on average in employee time and expenses to complete award submissions, but it goes up for bigger firms. The average was almost $700,000, and one firm said that it spent $5 million in employee time and expenses in 1 year to handle these awards.
So how are lawyers ranked, Sarah?
There are tons of ways. There's lists called Super Lawyers, Best Lawyers, Top Lawyers, Law Dragon, and they can be ranked by practice area, by geography, by top women, top 40 under 40. Basically any way that you could slice or dice it, someone has found a way to make a list to give an award to a lawyer.
And how important are these rankings to a law firm? Do they absolutely have to have them to get business?
Well, the problem is that in law, everyone likes to mimic what all of their peers are doing. And we're at the point where everyone submits to these awards, puts them on their website. And now that it's at this point, no one feels they can pull back from them. But when you talk to clients, you know, who are the ones giving law firms new business, most of them overwhelmingly say, we don't look at awards and rankings. We look at, you know, the cases the firm has done or other qualities or referrals. And so it doesn't seem like they're getting much new business from it, but they just feel the need to keep up with their peers and continue to accumulate these awards just to stay competitive.
We're speaking with Sarah Randazzo of the Wall Street Journal. Sarah, do lawyers like or need to be ranked?
Well, ego is definitely a big part of this. Maybe a little more than other industries. Lawyers are very competitive, very ego-driven. They've competed their whole life through law school to always be at the top of their class. And so even the lawyers who roll their eyes a little bit and say these are silly have, you know, dozens of them listed on their website bios. So I do think the lawyers personally like getting them. It's just a matter of whether it's getting a little out of hand.
Yeah. Are some of the awards actually kind of on the bogus side? Can you separate
them?
Yeah,
so there's definitely more legitimate awards and more bogus awards. Legal trade publications and some respected brands have been giving out awards for a couple of decades that are generally seen as somewhat reliable. But now every day there's new ones cropping up that a lot of marketers forwarded me these emails where it's just any combination of words you can think of, lawyers of distinction, you know, international deal makers, and they're essentially pay-for-play organizations that will say, oh, you've been selected for this honor. Just pay us a $1,000 membership fee and we'll give you all the details about the award.
It's a great racket. This weekend's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal legal reporter Sarah Randazzo. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for joining us. What could change our future in a massive way? Tech analyst Rob Enderle, founder and principal of the Enderle Group, has a handful of potentially world-changing technologies. Rob, you're inspired here by a book.
Yeah, I read The Punch Escrow by Talon Klein. It's hard science fiction, and for those that don't know the difference between hard and soft science fiction, hard science fiction is actually based on science, and so they build a story of the future that is at least credible, if not probable. And so the end result is you're kind of learning while you're being entertained.
All right, so one of these technologies you looked at, which I struggle to wrap my arms around at times, is organic printing. Explain that.
Well, organic printing is when you actually print an organic object. In other words, print something you might be able to eat along those lines. And we've had a number of efforts to automate things. For instance, there's an automated icing machine that's in the market right now that can take whatever your image is and create it and print it on your cake. But there's a lot of work right now to take organic core components and then use them to construct food, very much in line with the Star Trek replicators that we saw on TV a few years back. So the idea, you know, you say, okay, we want a casserole, and you hit a few buttons, and out comes a casserole. made from components. We're getting closer, and of course that would change a lot of things, particularly in developing nations where food is often problematic.
Jeez, I mean, what could that do for the world?
Well, amazing stuff. The components themselves are relatively easy to protect, so they don't typically have the refrigeration requirements that completed food does. And in their liquid form, they're far easier to store and protect. And so you could drop a machine with the components into a remote area and just print food for folks that right now don't have it.
All right. How about technology number two you looked at, advanced bioengineering, meaning what?
What happened is Google recently released a whole bunch of bioengineered mosquitoes in Silicon Valley to eliminate the mosquitoes that are currently carrying a disease. They make whoopee and then they don't have babies. So the end result is we're already going down this path of creating insects that can do different things. In the book, the concept they created was a mosquito hybrid that would consume pollution and urinate water, creating some interesting always-on rain. But this idea of being able to architect living organisms that can go in and clean up pollution, might even be able to be militarized, though we certainly appreciate not having dive-bombing killer mosquitoes anytime soon. But this is coming and certainly would change our entire environment.
We're speaking with tech analyst Rob Enderle. He's written a piece entitled The Five Technologies We Need to Change the World. Explain wireless power and the potential for that.
Well, so jumping to wireless power, one of the big problems with electric cars is batteries and worrying about whether or not you're going to run out of power, because unlike a gas car, if you run out of power, you're not running down to the gas station getting a can of gas. You're going to be towed unless somebody has a 30-mile-long extension cord you can charge from. So being able to solve that problem is huge for companies like Tesla. Qualcomm has created a technology called Halo that could be placed in roads and allow cars to charge while they're driving. Think about, rather than having a 300 or 400 mile limit for the new Model 3 from Tesla, being able to get on a freeway and drive until you couldn't drive anymore as long as you stayed on the freeway and connected to power. That would give electric cars an advantage over gas cars because you wouldn't have to stop, and probably drive, make a lot of husbands happy and a lot of spouses, a lot of wives looking at getting new husbands. And they're not the only ones. Witricity is another company looking at this and providing electricity to cars as they operate.
Thanks, Rob. Tech analyst Rob Enderle, principal and founder of the tech advisory firm called The Enderle Group. It's 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you're with us. Time now for a travel update, and it's brought to you by Lexington Hotels. Get away and save up to 30% at participating Lexington and Red Lion Hotels when you book by September 4th. Book your hotel stay and save today. Don't get confused if you visit Cincinnati Northern Kentucky Airport and see a pair of miniature horses walking around. You're not at a farm, and you're not lost. The two-foot-tall horses, Harvey and Wendy, wander the terminal to greet passengers before and after their flights in order to keep down the stress levels of some travelers. It's a story from Wall Street Journal reporter Shabani Matani. Shabani, what did you see?
In Cincinnati Northern Kentucky Airport, they have a very unique program to calm travelers who are nervous about flying. They bring in these mini horses twice a month, and they basically wander around the sort of non-secure areas of the terminal when passengers enter and get off the planes. You can pet them, take pictures of them, hang out with them, whatever you want to do.
Wow. They have handlers, I presume, right?
Yes. So they've had to go through a lot of training. Obviously, the airport isn't the most natural place for a mini horse, but these are therapy horses, so this is kind of their job. Usually, they go to nursing homes, children's hospitals, that kind of thing. They help patients with dementia, children with terminal illnesses, kind of forget what they're going through for a while. And the handlers were actually traveling through Cincinnati once, and they saw a very distressed passenger, as passengers can get in the airport if their flight's, going to be delayed like 10 hours or whatever.
Yeah.
And they were like, what would be perfect if we brought our mini horses in? So they trained them specifically for this.
Wow, and they train them extensively. Explain what they go through.
Right, so they've had to have hours of training. You got to basically replicate the environment of the airport for the mini horses. So they would drag suitcases up to them, kind of roll them around them to make sure that they got used to the sound, had, you know, kids sort of interact with them on a more sort of up-close and personal basis. You know, kids can kind of run up to the horses when they get excited and things. So, yeah, they had to do that for hours. They also had to learn how to transition from carpet to you know, tiled floor and make sure they didn't slip because, obviously, the airport floors are kind of different in different places, so they had to do that as well.
Do they ever act up, or are they trained that well?
No, they're trained pretty well, so I was with the horses for quite a long time. They were really chill. I think this is kind of their sort of full-time job. So mini horses are chosen instead of any other kind of breed of horse, including ponies, because they're just the calmest breed and easiest to sort of train for this purpose to be therapy animals. So, no, they don't really act up. I guess a lot of people have also been asking me, you know, where do they do their business and get brought outside outside the airport for potty breaks. So that's fine, too.
Very good. So is there evidence that they do work as de-stressors?
At least from the look of people's faces, for sure. People were super excited. There was one lady who, you know, said that she herself is an anxious traveler, and she was just sort of losing it. She was so excited. She kept saying, you know, I must have died and gone to heaven. This is amazing. Like, this is so great for someone like me. So, yeah, I mean, I think it definitely helps for some.
Thanks, Shabani. Wall Street Journal reporter Shabani Matani. It's 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Well, it's one thing to conquer the Appalachian Trail, all 2,200 miles of it. It's another thing to do it when your legs are paralyzed. Doctors didn't think she'd ever walk again, but 41-year-old Stacy Kozel never gave up hope. The Ohio woman was in a car accident in 2014. The combination left her a quadriplegic, and it was unlikely that she would ever regain the strength to walk. She spent a year in a wheelchair. She recovered control of her arms and upper body, but not her legs. And we talk about the combination, we got to mention, too, that she has lupus as well. But 2 years later, she became the first person with her condition to tackle the Appalachian Trail, which runs from Maine to Georgia. USA Today says with computer-powered leg braces that help her walk, she averaged about 10 miles a day on the Appalachian Trail, but has done up to 30 miles in one day on her latest hike. Because, you see, doing the East Coast isn't enough. Now she's on to her next challenge. She's hiking the Pacific Crest Trail from the U.S.-Mexico border all the way up to the border of the U.S. and Canada. By the way, she's made it through California. At the beginning of August, she had made it to Oregon, still moving north. That'll do it for this hour. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.